except Ali Kaparam, the most heinous liar, Naram, a human being. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. There is nothing more sinful than untruthfulness. Because of this, Mother Earth once said, I can bear any heavy thing except a person who is a liar. Purport. On the surface of the earth, there are many great mountains and oceans that are very heavy, and Mother Earth has no difficulty carrying them. But she feels very much overburdened when she carries even one person who is a liar. It is said that in Kali Yuga, lying is a common affair. Mayaiva Vyavaharike, Bhagavatam 12.2.3. Even in the most common dealings, people are accustomed to speaking so many lies. No one is free from the sinful reactions of speaking lies. Under the circumstances, one can just imagine how this has overburdened the earth, and indeed, the entire universe. Om Jnana Timanandisha Jana Jana Salakaya Chaksudun Mutanina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Panchakal Patrubhischa Kripasindhavyevacha Patitano Pavane Vyo Vaishaveva Namo Namaha. So this is Bali Maharaj speaking about the need for truthfulness and honesty, basically stating, how can I withdraw my promise? How can I not be an honest and truthful person? And he's citing different reasons and examples for this. And here he is saying something that we have all heard very often, I think, this quote from Mother Earth, that Mother Earth can bear so many things, except cannot bear a person who is a liar. It's kind of interesting here, because it says that it is said that Mother Earth once said, but there's not actually the source of where Mother said this. But does anyone know any more about this? Is there a? I couldn't find if there's a particular scripture or passage where Bhumi or Mother Earth actually states this, so I guess this is it. Is it? So in some places in the Vedas, the statement is there. And anyway, it is there because Bali Maharaj is quoting from some other scripture this quotation from Mother Earth. But it's very, very significant and very important for us, this idea of truthfulness. Prabhupada is pointing out in the purport that truthfulness is very short supply in Kali Yuga. In fact, Kali Yuga is actually characterized by a lack of truthfulness. The verse that Srila Prabhupada quotes, 12.2.3, states, men and women, this is in the part of the Bhagavatam, the 12th canto, where the symptoms of Kali Yuga are being mentioned. And one of the symptoms is this verse, men and women will live together merely because of superficial attraction, and success in business will depend on deceit. I think that's the part that's specifically referred to here. The deceit or lying is actually the basis of business in Kali Yuga. The rest of the verse says, womanliness and manliness will be judged according to one's expertise in sex, and a man will be known as a Brahmin just by wearing a thread. So these are all symptoms of the degradation of religious principles in Kali Yuga, and the 12th canto gives many, many of these different symptoms like this. So this idea of truthfulness or lying is a very, very important principle of religion. It's mentioned in several different places in the scriptures. Here it's interesting because this is Mother Earth, who is of course represented by Bhumi the cow, is stating this verse. It immediately brings to mind the story in the first canto of Maharaj Parikshit and how he comes upon Kali, who is beating the bull, who is Dharma personified. And in that particular passage, very instructive in the Bhagavatam, it's discussed how the four legs of Dharma, the bull, represent the four religious principles, and that only one leg is now standing, and that is the leg of Satyam, or truthfulness. So Kali was trying to actually, is destroying the last leg or the last bit of religiosity that there is left on the planet, and that is truthfulness. So there's a little bit of that left in Kali Yuga, but it's being attacked by Kali. So that's it's a very important passage, a very important understanding for us. I read a couple of those verses from the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is in the 17th chapter, the first canto, 24 and 25. The verse starts out, Tapa Shocham Dayam Satyam, which are the four religious principles. It says, in the age of such a truthfulness, your four legs were established by the four principles of austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. But it appears that the three of your legs are broken due to rampant irreligion in the form of pride, lust for women, and intoxication. You are now standing on one leg only, which is your truthfulness, and you are somehow or other hobbling along. But quarrel personified Kali, flourishing by deceit, is also trying to destroy that leg. So here we have the situation where Kali, who's called quarrel personified, and by the principle of deceit or lying, is trying to destroy this leg of truthfulness. So the four religious principles are mentioned: austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. These are very important, and Prabhupada referred to these a lot in different lectures and in different purports. This comes up quite often. And what's interesting about these four religious principles is Prabhupada pointed out that these are universal principles. They don't pertain to a particular religious idea or to a particular philosophy or to a particular political program or a particular, you know, party or anything like that. But these are basic principles of human life: cleanliness, austerity, mercy, truthfulness. And so once Prabhupada said that we don't have to support any specific religion, but any government should support these principles of religion, because these are the principles that will create harmony and create peacefulness and a very pleasant, prosperous civilization. So these are very important. And, of course, they are pillars of Vedic civilization. And now, of course, they are being destroyed. And they are being destroyed by these very specific, these qualities of religion or principles are being destroyed by these four activities that are being mentioned. And in the purport to that verse, here the Prabhupada explains a little more. He says, by pride, either artificial or real, the resultant action of austerity is spoiled. So in other words, you know, if you perform some austerity, but then you're very proud of it, or pride comes into it, then it's like it's diminished. It's no longer of value. That austerity that may be performed, you know, is completely eroded by false pride. Too much addiction, I'm sorry, by too much affection for female association, cleanliness is spoiled. So basically, sex life destroys the quality of cleanliness. And too much addiction to intoxication, mercy is spoiled. So the quality of mercy is diminished by intoxication. And of course, all these things are very prominent in Kali Yuga. And by too much lying propaganda, truthfulness is spoiled. So truthfulness is destroyed by lying propaganda. Deceit is also a word that's used. But whenever there is falsity, deceit, lying propaganda, all of these types of things destroys this last quality of truthfulness. So, as we know, in Satya Yuga, all four qualities were there, and the qualities diminish gradually as the yugas progress. And so by the time we come to the fourth yuga, all three of the qualities are destroyed, and truthfulness is the only one remaining. And it's even in very short supply, and it is being attacked by the onset of Kali Yuga. So now we see that even this concept of truthfulness, or this religious principle of truthfulness, is very much gone in Kali Yuga. And in fact, we almost expect it. It's almost taken for granted that our politicians or business people or in the law and things like this, that there'll be deception, there'll be deceit, there'll be a lack of truthfulness. You know, anytime you hear the news, there's just like one scandal after another of politicians doing something dishonest or taking bribes, or every year there's several congressmen that end up either being accused or going to jail or something because of this. And we don't even take it so seriously anymore. It's almost to be expected. You think, oh, that's the way it is. And in business, you know, it's just commonplace. It's expected that in business there's going to be some cheating. I was thinking about how when you go to India, how blatant it is. You know, it's very much on the surface. You know, I always figure if I only get cheated 10 or 20%, I've done pretty good, you know, because I figure that's kind of your tax for being a Westerner. You're going to get cheated naturally, you know, you just expect it. You know, now America, you don't have that so much. It's much more in the background. And it's done very, very skillfully. You know, in other words, it's not that you walk in the store and you're necessarily going to get cheated, but you know, the bankers and all of that industry has obviously just cheated us all out of several hundred billion dollars. You know, in this last. So you know, they're very expert in America and at a more subtle level, but a very gross level in a sense too, because it's so much more money of this cheating. So this cheating and lack of truthfulness is there everywhere. And when you do see honesty, it's almost a surprise. It's almost unexpected. You know? So this is where we find ourselves. Now, of course, in a proper culture, in Vedic civilization, according to our scriptures, truthfulness is an expected principle. Anybody with any culture or of any higher class or any religious principles is naturally going to be truthful. And in fact, truthfulness is one of the primary qualities. This quality of satyam is honored above almost all qualities. And also in the Bhagavad Gita in 1842, you know, the qualities of Brahmins are given. And there the word arjavam, honesty, is used as one of the qualities of a Brahmin. Arjavam. But they're always honest. They always, and a Brahmin speaks the truth. And of course, a Vaishnava is considered to be even above the level of Brahmin. So naturally, a Vaishnava always speaks the truth. So this is a very, very important that we have this quality, and we try to all develop within ourselves this quality of truthfulness. Although it's very difficult in Kali Yuga, and it more or less runs contrary, you know, to this age and to the common principles that we see in culture. I think another important point is to think about truthfulness and what it really means. Truthfulness really means more than the absence of lying. I mean, one thing we could say that if I don't tell a lie, then I'm being truthful. But we understand from the scriptures that it's really a little bit deeper. That to be truthful, one needs to know the truth. It seems self-evident, but actually when you think about it, one could be very much mistaken, but be very sincere about that mistaken belief and think that one is being truthful. But in reality, if they don't have knowledge, then there's no real truth. So there's a philosophical connection between these two principles of truth and knowledge. This is something philosophers like Aristotle and others have discussed for thousands of years. In other words, it's not enough just to have a belief system. In other words, I may believe something to be true, but is it actually true? I may believe that all life comes from a combination of chemicals. I may sincerely believe that. I may even pose good scientific arguments. But is it true? No, it's not true. So in other words, real truth has to be based upon knowledge, not just one's sincerity of one's belief system. So that real knowledge must be there. And as we see, particularly in the material world, when we study so much of science, philosophy, so much speculative knowledge is there, that there are different degrees of knowledge. And much of what we see in the material world is very much relative knowledge. You know, it's relative truth. It's relative to the particular understanding and amount of knowledge that is there at the moment. In spiritual life, our scriptures often talk about, and Srila Prabhupada used this term many times, absolute truth, right? We hear this all the time. Prabhupada says the absolute truth, Krishna the absolute truth. Why do we say absolute truth? It's an important, you know, these phrases and terms that Prabhupada used repeatedly are often very, very important and significant. Because saying absolute truth distinguishes it from the relativity of material knowledge. Basically, all material knowledge is relative. Spiritual knowledge is of a different category. It's absolute, which means it doesn't change. In other words, Krishna is God today, and Krishna was God 1,000 years ago, and Krishna was God, you know, many, many yugas ago, and Krishna is God in every universe. There's nothing relative about that understanding. Spiritual knowledge is for all time and place. It's absolute. Most of the knowledge of the material world is relative, and it will change. you read a textbook from 30 years ago and a textbook today, and they have a little different slant on things. You know, of course, they think this is progress. They think this is a virtue, that our knowledge is always increasing. Just see, we know more than we knew. You know, but it's going to completely change 50 years from now. So what good is the knowledge that you're posing now? I mean, that's our argument, of course. So we are interested in absolute truth. And one who is truthful is one who understands this absolute truth. Of course, the Vedanta Sutra, the very famous first aphorism, is Etato Brahma Jigyasa, that the important aspect, the goal of human life, the duty of human life, is to inquire into the absolute truth. This is considered to be just, this is what we do. This is what, as human beings, that is what we're here for, to inquire into the absolute truth. Now, of course, your average person isn't really thinking this way, that this is what, when they wake up in the morning thinking, oh, today I've got to go and inquire into the absolute truth and, you know, understand, you know, the nature of reality, understand what is the essence of everything, understanding what the purpose of life is. But those who are a little bit intelligent, they do. People who are a little bit intelligent, they care about these things. They inquire about these things. Now, usually they don't get very good answers because there aren't very many people who have knowledge, who have this absolute truth. So, of course, we are continually reminded, or we should be reminding ourselves, of the great fortune that we have of having access to not relative truth, to not mundane or superficial knowledge, but to this pure absolute truth which is given to us from the Vedic literatures through Srila Prabhupada, our spiritual master. So, absolute truth, we know what that is. Truth is understanding God, understanding Krishna, and understanding our relationship as servant of God. Anything that is different from that is not truth. Even if a person may feel or think that they are a truthful person, they are not really giving truth. And therefore, there's very little value in anything which deviates from this siddhanta of understanding our position and relationship with God. So this is one point that's very important to think about in truthfulness. Another point I was thinking about truthfulness is also our own internal truthfulness. What does truthfulness mean to us as devotees and to us as individuals? How do we become truly truthful? I mean, of course, in one sense, we can say it means not consciously saying falsehoods. But beyond that is also the concept of understanding oneself and being very honest about oneself, one's position, and even understanding perhaps one's faults or anartas in trying to, trying to purify oneself through that understanding. And the process of purification, the process of Krishna consciousness, does require a certain amount of truthfulness. It requires us to initially understand our own position. Now, this is difficult for us because it is not the nature of the conditioned soul. The nature of the conditioned soul is to be an illusion. I found this verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam in the third canto, 12.2. It was describing the creation. And what was what's the first thing that Brahma created? He created illusion at first. It's described that, so the self-deception is there right from the very beginning of creation. In this verse it says, Brahma first created the nescient engagements like self-deception, mohan is the word, the sense of death, anger after frustration, the sense of false ownership, and the illusory bodily conception, or forgetfulness of one's real identity. So in other words, to create a place in this material world for us conditioned souls to come to forget God, you first have to create illusion. In other words, without illusion, without the sense of self-deception, which means not knowing who my real self is, a servant of God, but taking on the false conception or the false ego, understanding that I am this body, I am this mind and intelligence, that has to be there. So Brahma had to create that sense of illusion first, then everything else could be created for a place for the jiva souls who wanted to forget their relationship with Krishna to come to. So it's natural there's going to be a certain amount of self-deception that we all have because it was created right from the beginning. It's part of our, not of our actual nature, but it's part of our conditioned nature when we come into this material world. So it's not so surprising that we're not always completely honest with ourselves. If we were completely honest with ourselves, we wouldn't be able to stay in this material world because the real self is servant of Krishna, and we would know that that is our proper position. But we often also do not really understand completely or confront those anartas or those bad qualities that we may have in ourselves. And the problem with that is that hinders our spiritual life. Because we are so conditioned from so many lifetimes, and we have so many qualities which tend to take us away from Krishna rather than towards Krishna, these are all hindrances on the path of spiritual realization. So the process of Krishna consciousness, of course, is a process of purification. We have to become purified from those bad habits, those bad qualities, those attachments, those illusions, all of those things, in a way that we can give up that material attachment and return to Krishna. You know, but sometimes that's very difficult for us. And it's naturally for the living entity, because we always have this discrepancy. But, you know, when we try to evaluate ourselves and where we're at, sometimes that's not a very pleasant topic, is it? At least myself, if I think very honestly about where I'm at in my spiritual life or material life or almost any sphere of life, I often find that I'm rather dissatisfied. You know, I'm not dissatisfied with, you know, the present situation. That's not necessarily bad. We'll get to that in a moment. But this is natural for all conditioned souls in this material world. And in fact, this is something that psychology often studies. There's this discrepancy between the ideal self and the real self. In other words, we all have a sense of what we should be ideally, even whether we're a devotee or non-devotee. There's this ideal self that we have. But yet, the reality is we're usually short of that. There's so many problems, or there's so many discrepancies, so we have this cognitive dissonance. You know, we have this problem with how do we bridge this gap between what we think we should be and reality, what we really are. So, because this creates a certain anxiety. So, for the materialists, the way psychologists often explain this is that we relieve that anxiety of that discrepancy by different defense mechanisms. Actually, Freud first talked about these defense mechanisms. And, well, he's discredited for many things. This is one idea he came up with, which was probably pretty good. So he talked about things like denial, rationalization, intellectualization, projection, repression. There's a whole list of them. And some of them are considered healthy, and some not so healthy, and some are neurotic, and some are, all of these things. So there's different ways that the living entity copes with this discrepancy, you know, that they have of how they would like things to be and how things really are. So basically, all of these different defense mechanisms are different types of mohana, or self-deception, illusion. Ways that we, the living entity, deceives themselves into thinking that everything's okay. My life is good, I'm okay, everything's all right. Because when we deal with, when we confront not only our own internal discrepancies, but the real issues of life, birth, death, disease, and old age. How does one deal with this? How does one accept these things? It requires a certain amount of psychological adjustment. In other words, what we're really saying is that human beings almost unconsciously, purposefully, put themselves in illusion. You know, they accept illusion because it's a way of coping with the material world, and coping with their own situation. Now, sometimes we see with people where these defense mechanisms break down and they stop working. In other words, the reality of their life may actually be so painful or so difficult or so stressful that these things don't even work. You know, then they have all kinds of other issues like excessive guilt or shame or embarrassment, low self-esteem, etc. So in other words, this is where we end up getting caught if we only think materially. That if, you know, because of the discrepancy of the way we'd like things to be and the way things really are, we're either going to feel anxious, depressed, you know, guilty, have low self-esteem about it, or we completely repress all those things and we keep pretending that everything is just fine. Pretty dismal, isn't it? The material world is pretty dismal. There's really no real way to win in the material world. The only way out is through spiritual understanding. So how does a devotee look at these things? First of all, as devotees, we do accept our limitations. We accept the greatest limitation, this material body is limited. It's finite. It's going to die at a certain time. It's going to get old, diseased, you know, and eventually death comes. We understand our own anartas. We understand that we have so many bad qualities that we have had for many millions of years, and the worst quality that we have is that we have forgotten Krishna. That's the real understanding, the realization that we come to, that all of my difficulties that I'm experiencing are because I chose to give up the loving devotional service of the Lord. Right, so that's a little heavy. But we don't get, Prabhupada said that guilt is good only up to a certain point, to the point that it motivates us to surrender to Krishna. Once we have understood our situation, and we have realized that we must surrender to Krishna, and we actively engage in the process of sadhana bhakti, we take up the orders of the spiritual master, there's no need to beat ourselves up with guilt, shame, embarrassment, and all of these things, because we are now rightly situated, and we are doing what we need to do to reach that position of purity, that each individual soul, you know, each of us is a pure soul, and we simply need to engage in the process of purification to return to that original position. So the devotee is actually very hopeful. We're very hopeful because we know our true identity. We know that the true identity is one of Satchitananda, that we are eternal, we are full of bliss, happiness, and we are full of knowledge. We are also very hopeful in our knowledge of the process of devotional service, the process of purification. We know that the anartas that we have, all of those difficulties, all of the things that, you know, we'd rather not face within ourselves, those things will become purified. And we are consciously and actively working in such a way to purify, you know, all of those difficulties and all of those issues. So thus the devotee can remain very hopeful and does not need to despair or feel overly guilty. But sometimes it's good to feel a little bit guilty, you know, enough to kind of push us along, enough to propel us. You know, we shouldn't become complacent. We shouldn't think, oh, I'm just fine, everything's great, you know, I'm okay. You know, if it takes me a few lifetimes, what's the big deal? We actually should feel motivated to become purified. We should become motivated to engage fully in the process of Krishna consciousness and to fully serve our spiritual master. I know I've quoted this before, but I think every few months it's worth a repeat. It's one of my favorite verses of the Bhagavatam, 11th canto, 20th chapter. I didn't write it down. I think it's verse 32. This is in, of course, the Uddhava Gita, and Krishna in the chapter on pure devotional service, where Krishna is telling Uddhava all the different processes are there, and then finally Krishna tells him about pure devotional service and the process of purification and how one does this. And he specifically addresses the plight of the conditioned soul, the devotee in this material world who is trying to become purified. And so Krishna says, having awakened faith in the narration of my glories, being disgusted with all material activities, knowing that all sense gratification leads to misery, but still being unable to renounce all sense enjoyment, my devotee should remain happy and worship me with great faith and conviction. Even though he is sometimes engaged in sense enjoyment, my devotee knows that all sense gratification leads to a miserable result, and he sincerely repents such activities. So anyway, I've always found that to be a very instructive, very sobering, but also very hopeful verse. Because Krishna is recognizing that in the material world, even devotees will have struggles, that we may still be struggling with attachment to sense gratification. In my case, it's not a question of maybe. We're struggling, you know, with material desires. And Krishna recognizes that. And so he's saying, don't despair, don't give up, don't beat yourself up, but remain happy and worship me with great faith and devotion. Continue the process of devotional service. And at the same time, understand the principle of sense gratification. Understand the miseries of this material world. And he says we should be sincerely repent those material activities. So we do regret our many, many lifetimes of material activities and engagement in the material world. And we may even regret that we still have so many anartas within our heart. We have so many desires, material desires that are still there. But nevertheless, we have this confidence. And we have this hope that if we engage in devotional service, then we will become purified. And we will again engage in our pure, loving, devotional service to the Lord. So it's also described in the Nectar of Instruction that, the six qualities are given, but the first three qualities are particularly of note. The qualities that the devotee strives to perform devotional service with: utsahat, enthusiasm; nishchayat, confidence; and dharyat, patience. So we have to have enthusiasm in devotional service. We have that confidence that the process will work. We have confidence in the instructions of the spiritual master and the scriptures. But we also are patient. We also know that it may take some time. After so many lifetimes in this material world, it may take some time for the process of purification to fully work. So in that way, we are engaged in actual truthfulness. Real truthfulness means understanding our relationship with God. And if we are acting in that capacity, acting as pure spirit soul, acting as servants of God, then that is actually truthful. That is the truthful position. Any other position is a position of illusion. So, again, this truthfulness is very much stressed in this verse, is particularly talking about that, and how the earth cannot bear anyone who is not truthful, who is a liar. And, of course, the result of that is the buildup of sinful reactions as being described in this verse. And we can see that the age of Kali becomes further and further degraded as these accumulation of sinful reactions build. And, of course, therefore truthfulness becomes destroyed even more. So as devotees, we have a great opportunity because we have the truth. We have the absolute truth. We have the means of obtaining that truth. And we have the means and the knowledge and ability to give that truth to others. And thus we can actually alter or change the course of Kali Yuga. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Further questions, comments? Yes, Guru?
Some of the statements you made, that we accept that Krishna is the truth, naturally someone will say, well, how do you know that? And we come back with authority. But authority has been so much debunked by the scientific method. People are always exploring new ideas of what the truth may be in so many different circumstances. So how do we point to something and say, here's the truth, here it is, you know, can see, it's self-evident? What's the easiest way to do that in a short, concise way?
A short, concise way. I remember there was one conversation, a morning walk, you're thinking where Srila Prabhupada was sort of asking some of his disciples that same sort of question. They were posing the different answers about how we knew that Krishna was God. And because it's true, I mean, there seems to be a certain degree of faith involved. And to those who are scientifically minded, they may not accept that. We can cite so much authority, scriptural authority, etc., but this may not be accepted. And as I remember this one conversation, at least one way that so many answers were given, and finally one devotee said, you know, because you, something that, to the degree that because you feel it, because you know it, because it's something that you realize within the heart, and Prabhupada said, yes. Yes, ultimately understanding Krishna, understanding spiritual life is a question of spiritual realization. you know, we have the concepts of jnana and vijnana, and of course the scientists are working within the realm of jnana and trying to manipulate that. And on that level, it is probably very difficult to convince someone of something which is beyond science, which is beyond materialism. So therefore, when you're in the realm of spiritual knowledge, spiritual truth, how does one understand spiritual truth? That can only really be understood on the spiritual level, you know, through the spiritualized mind, intelligence, and heart. You know, so it's really a process of realization, and one has to gain that realization, which comes through the process of devotional service, which is all a little bit circular in one sense, but that's why a lot of times Srila Prabhupada was more concerned with making sure that the person arguing with him got a plate of prasadam on the way out the door, right? You know, because ultimately it's very difficult to they can go round and round with their material arguments, but if we inject spiritual energy into their cognitive processes, then there might be some real change. And there's a lot of ways to answer that. Maybe you have an idea. There's another way that could be.
Well, the next part of the question is basically, so many people are convinced, as you said, about different things, you know, that Jesus is God, or the Third Reich is meant to be the master race, and, you know, they're convinced by certain things. They say, well, here's a proof, you know, the Third Reich is not the master race, you know, they got defeated. Okay, so they have to kind of accept on that level. And so, but when you get into, as you say, the spiritual realm, that Jesus is God, it's all based on, you know, one or two slokas in their testament, and Jesus, of course, never said he was God, and this goes back and forth into, you know, what is the reality of these things. But they will say, well, I know it in my heart.
Yeah.
You know, I have a realization in my heart. So how do we, not that we want to argue with Christians.
Well, you bring up a really good point, because both things are there. In fact, I had, you know, earlier I'd said that belief does not equal truth necessarily. So, it can't be a material belief. It has to be a spiritual realization. You know, but Erwin Prabhupada mentioned that spiritual knowledge has to be, what was it, that philosophy without religion is, you know, dry speculation, and religion without philosophy is sentimental. You know, or was that what it was, sentimental? Sentimentalism. So, I mean, I think that's an important concept, that the two have to be there. In fact, I mean, if we actually look at individual tenets of our philosophy, there are many, many very good arguments. You know, you can make very good and very convincing arguments for all the points of our philosophy, which Prabhupada does throughout. I mean, there's so many good analogies, right? So many good examples that ways that we can explain the philosophy. It's not just based on some blind faith. Well, you know, you just have to believe it. You know, no, both have to be there. There has to be good argument, there has to be, you know, rational argument, there has to be scriptural justification, and ultimately there also has to be sort of the inner realization or inner change of heart. I think it's really those things have to be put together. And as you say, like the person who says, well, I believe it's in my heart, you know, that's kind of missing the rational or the logical argument and just being sentimental. And of course the scientist is missing, you know, the spiritual realization and just being in his head. Madame Mahan.
I was also thinking about the sat and sattva, you know, that the sat is eternal.
Yeah.
So that's true. And the asat is temporary, so that was relative. And you had mentioned about how austerity is ruined by pride from those four things. So I was thinking about the result of austerity is a separation between the living entity and his illusion of material body, basically. So when one performs austerity, he doesn't listen to his mind specifically, and he gains some separation for a moment, because we're always absorbed in it. So if you don't listen to it for a while, then you see it separate. I can still exist without this. But when there's pride, it goes back into identifying with the external again, or with the mind and the body, so that result of the austerity is destroyed. That was one point. And of course, there's Bhagavad Gita 9 too, Raja Vidya Raja Guyam. It says, it's perfection of religion, because the self is revealed, the soul is revealed by direct perception. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. I think I'm sort of trying to say that in kind of a fumbling way. That's a good scriptural way from Bhagavad Gita. It's direct perception of the self, and that direct perception is obviously from the spiritual platform,
and
spiritual
also,
realization.
There's another similar verse like that, 11:2:42, where three things happen simultaneously.
Yeah, the food analogy.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you say that? That's a good one.
Push back.
Give us a translation of the microphone.
Oh.
Or what?
I don't know the exact, but it says three things happen simultaneously. For one who has taken shelter of Krishna, that he has devotion, direct perception, and gives up anything that's not related to Krishna. Just like when one eats, he gets three things, like satisfaction, nourishment, and strength, and he's not hungry but the key part was one who takes shelter of Krishna. These three things happen simultaneously.
Right. Well, thank you. Anything else? Yes, Parijata.
You mentioned a few days ago, verses ago, it said in flattering a woman to bring her under control, in choking, in a marriage ceremony, in earning one's livelihood, when one's life is in danger, in protecting cults and Brahminical culture, or in protecting a person from an enemy's hand, falsity is never condemned. So, falsity means untruthfulness, doesn't it? And you were saying, like in India, you always get cheated when you buy something, and you know, the merchant always tells you, "Yo, for you, I don't take any profit," you know. You hear that all the time. And this is also untruthfulness. But we know that he's lying, because otherwise how can he make any profit? So, I mean, you're explaining in this, untruthfulness means something much deeper.
Mm.
That untruthfulness, like Mother Earth here said, is more like the false ego, to be untruthful to who we are, and isn't it? That right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was.
So the other, kind of like the other untruthfulness.
There's two levels of truthfulness being discussed. One is, as you said, the cheating, the saying a lie.
Right.
And then
no,
the deeper truthfulness is not understanding the absolute truth, understanding one's true nature, understanding one's relationship with God.
So I wanted to say that this other untruthfulness is like a joke. It's permitted. It's a way of life, like in India. You know, you talk like this all the time. It's not like...
But it wouldn't be for a Brahmin. A true Brahmin, you know, retains truthfulness, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's why they're not vicious. They're not,
but still,
you know.
it's not that deeper kind of truthfulness.
Well, in fact, even sometimes Srila Prabhupada even joked like that, didn't he? Like, it's like some of this cheating was just, you expect it. It's just the way of life almost. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. I'll go to Srila Prabhupada.